360's The Week That Was, the most listened to hour in Territory Radio. The Territory leaders break down this week's big issues.
And good morning and welcome to the show. The Week That Was, now proudly brought to you by De Silva Hebron, your local lawyers. A big hello to Dave De Silva and the team, and we're very pleased to have them on board as our sponsors. Now also broadcasting on 8HA in Alice Springs. And joining us in the studio this morning for The Week That Was, we have got the opposition leader, Leah Finocchiaro. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Happy Friday.
And we've got Robin Lamley, the member for Araluen. And so good to have you on the show and obviously broadcasting in Alice from midday.
Yes, people are catching on that you're emanating down there. You've got the sound waves connecting with us down there.
Spreading the word far and wide, Robin. And we've also got Natasha Files, the Health Minister and Leader of Government Business. Good morning.
Morning, Wolfie.
I'm not sure what's going on with the microphones this morning. They're all a bit
limp. Floppy.
Well, we will get into it, though, and we might start with the Northern Territory budget, because we learned the current state of the Northern Territory's finances when the Chief Minister handed down his second budget. And though he was keen to paint a very positive picture, much of that clawback can be attributed to a windfall in GST revenue to the tune of $738 million flowing into the Territory's coffers over the current and upcoming financial years, as the national GST pool has grown because of increased spending across the country. There is certainly some good news, significant improvements in debt and deficit, but we still have a $1.4 billion deficit for the upcoming financial year. The Territory's net debt is expected to reach $9 billion in 2021-22, $1 billion better than previously forecast. It's then set to expand to $11.4 billion by the end of the forward estimates period in 2024-2025. Now, taxpayers will then be forking out $478 million in annual interest repayments. Now, I know that we have obviously seen better figures than what we were anticipating, but there is no denying, even by the Chief Minister's own words, it is eye-watering levels of debt. We did catch up with different industry leaders throughout the week across a raft of different areas, from NT Cost to Master Builders to the Minerals Council of Australia's NT branch. And all were, aside, NT Costs were quite scathing of the budget and said that it had missed the mark when it comes to the community services sector. I know that many of the other industry groups were fairly positive, but I think that it is a budget that there were no cuts, aside from the public service wage freeze, which is touted to come into play, there were no real big cuts. There was some big spending in some areas to try to get things moving and some areas where we most definitely need it, i.e. Police and law and order. But there is no denying that, this is the kind of debt that our kids are going to be paying off.
Oh, there's no question, Katie. A $9.1 billion debt is pretty horrific. Borrowing $3.7 million a day just to keep the lights on, incredible. Paying $1.15 million a day in interest on the debt, that's nearly $5 million a day we can't spend on other things, and we can't invest into schools, we can't invest into roads or into healthcare. And it's critical, and it slowly but surely means this government will not be able to deliver the services it wants to deliver. And I think the first homeowners grant is a classic example of that. We've seen build bonus disappear off the books and the first homeowners grant be reduced, and that's because this government can't afford it. And that's a really tangible example of why debt is bad, because ultimately government then can't go and be proactive and deliver what it wants to deliver. So really serious levels of debt, and don't be so sure that things haven't been cut. There's a lot of movement in the budget books, and we're following a few rabbits down a few burrows, and we'll have more to say when we find the end of the burrow. But pretty tragic stuff, and no plan to get us out of it.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of sneaky cuts, and I don't have a problem with cuts. I think every government needs to cut in order to reprioritise their funding allocations and also to bring the budget back into balance, which we're so far from. It's not funny, but yes, the train wreck of the fiscal fiscal position of the Northern Territory just continues on. It was a very disappointing budget from a Central Australian perspective. But I think the most disappointing aspect of the budget from my perspective was the cut to the tax concessions for first home owners. Mm. I think that's devastating news, particularly for people outside of Darwin, where there are no blocks of land available to build on. They don't have the choice of a new build that doesn't have the stamp duty. They have to pay the stamp duty because they're buying existing homes. Mm. So that's an incredibly bad move. I think cut something else, but leave the concessions for first home owners in place. This is the new generation of Territorians we need to look after.
Katie, what we have seen is a confidence in the housing market, and we need to be careful that we're not creating an overinflated prices by those incentives. The budget does deliver, particularly in Central Australia, brings on land in Kilgariff. So,
which should have been done ages ago.
Well, a project that the CLP scrapped, it was all too hard for you when
rubbish.
You were in government.
No, rubbish. That's not true. We actually built Kilgariff.
It's a responsible budget, Katie, that makes sure that we deliver those key services, but also encourages investment and economic opportunities so that we can reset going forward.
Well, and I know the Chief Minister said throughout the week that one of the big savings is going to be the public service wage freeze. I'm not so sure. I actually don't reckon it's going to happen.
Yeah, well, that will remain to be seen. I mean, the Labor government have to go head-to-head with their union mates. Of course, this is using the public service as a scapegoat for their own wasteful spending. I mean, Garamilla Boulevard, $14 million over. The car park next to Parliament House, something like $9 million over. When you just have overruns, and the infrastructure minister, she's famous for saying, oh, well, you know, sometimes things go over, sometimes things go under. Well, thank goodness she's not the treasurer. You can't just waste money like that and hope for the best and then expect to be able to deliver services. I mean, the wage freeze will remain to be seen. But one other scary thing, Katie, is, of course, the $15 billion debt ceiling they want to implement. I mean, is that some sort of green light for government to actually reach that limit?
Spending. Yeah.
It's really scary. It's really scary.
I think the hard part at the moment as well is that, you know, a lot of regular people, it's hard to comprehend those levels of debt. You know, even for me, I think, goodness me, I can't kind of wrap my head around just how much money that is. And that was why one of the first things I asked the Chief Minister when he came in for a pre-recorded interview, it ended up being on Wednesday morning, how much we're actually paying a day on the interest, and also, you know, how much it's actually costing per day in terms of taxpayers paying off that level of debt. And, you know, I guess that's the only way to truly get your head around it. Yeah. This is when you look at it from those millions per day, because most Territorians run their household budgets in that way, where you know what your expenses are every week. You know how much each and every one of your bills costs every week. If you've got an additional expense come in, you know how that's going to impact your budget. And I guess there's lots of people questioning at the moment why the government isn't looking at their own budget in the same way that Territorians look at their household ones.
Well, Katie, it's interesting you say that. I've reflected on what this government is up to, and I think the introduction of a pay freeze for public servants is what you would call in any other place in the world an austerity measure. Yeah. They are implementing austerity measures because they know how deeply serious our debt position is. Now, you won't hear them talk about austerity measures. You won't hear them talk about any cuts at all. And there are cuts. I mean, probably the most astounding cut I found was a relatively small cut, but a significant cut to funding for domestic and family violence services by $1.5 million. Now, why would you do that when crime is exploding throughout the territory, and particularly assaults? But look, this government is doing a lot of stuff that they're not taking ownership for. Yep. Unlike the former CLP government, we did make cuts, we did try and make savings, we did try and bring the budget into balance, and we took ownership of that. But you don't hear that responsibility taken by the Gunner government, which is very disappointing and confusing for Territorians.
So, Katie, this is a budget around, you can't go in and cut and slash services, because you just end up in a cycle. And so we're being economically responsible. We're making sure that, you know, those big agencies have the resources to do their jobs, but also sticking to a budget. But at the same time, making sure we've got that investment. In the Northern Territory, the cost of delivering services is far greater than any other area.
But that hasn't changed, like, in the last 20 years. Or, you know, that's not something that's new in the last 6 years. That's something that's been the case always.
No, the Territory, certainly it is difficult to deliver services, and the cost of those services is different to other jurisdictions. And so we're trying to manage that budget without cutting those important staff, those important public sector staff.
From what everybody can see, though, from going through those budget books, and I'm keen to get everybody's take that's in the studio this morning, you know, from what I can gather, we've had a massive windfall when it comes to the GST. We also have quite a large amount of money coming in when it comes to the money that's coming in to manage the Howard Springs facility. Really, what savings measures have actually been made at this point to bring that budget, those dollars down?
Absolutely none. There's actually none. And this is the whole thing. We've been calling the Chief Minister the boy who cried wolf all week, because last year he said we're going to have a public service pay freeze. That hasn't happened yet and might not even happen at all. And he said it again this year. So it's all just talk. It's literally he's hoping for the best in August. Then, of course, we had this tough talk last year around holding CEOs accountable for their budgets. And then this year he acted even tougher. And this year he was like, oh, and then I'm going to be able to sack them if they go over budget, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, you can't just say these words. You actually have to do something. So nothing that the Chief Minister said was actually a measure of restraint. And certainly the Infrastructure Minister, we spent a whole day in question time asking her questions, and she showed no remorse or change of tune when it comes to how projects go over or under, in her words. I mean, it's just, you can't just go over like that. You've got to be understanding and doing the planning and doing the work that's required. But this government is so cavalier in how it spends other people's money. And I think that's the bit they miss. This is not their money. It's all of you listeners, it's your money. We had kids in the gallery. I looked up at them and I said, kids, these people over here. And I pointed to the government. I said, they're spending your parents' money. You know, it's craziness.
I think the big fat elephant in the room is, of course, the public service. You know, the massively bloated public service that we've got, and the austerity measures that they're flagging at the moment to freeze the pays is one step towards addressing a situation that's got out of control. I mean, we all know that the Darwin bloated public service is about shoring up the Labor vote. We know that. It's as clear as crystal. So the government won't talk about cutting jobs, but they'll definitely talk, as we know, about freezing the pays. That's where any economist, anyone who knows anything about finances, will go to when it comes to the Northern Territory. It came out very clearly in the Langalat report. We have to rein in the public service, and this is, you know, an indictment of a government that almost feels paralysed and impotent when it comes to actually doing anything about it.
But even that, we have to. You can't do what the CLP did when they came to government and slash and burn and put up the cost of living. You have to do it in a balanced way. And I can absolutely assure people, as the, you know, minister responsible for the health budget, you know, the single largest component of the Northern Territory government budget, it's hard work, and I think that Leah's comments are a little bit offensive, where she says, oh, there's just no care. We sit through, you know, the budget process starts back in November, and you sit there and you thoroughly go through your agency and you do look for those savings, but at the same time, you want to reinvest that into the service delivery.
But just taking
that
into account, you know, like, everybody is at pains to say, you know, that every minister is at pains to say, you know, we are making sure that we're not wasting money. We're making sure that we are doing things as, you know, as well as we can when it comes to the budget. But then at Christmas time, we see a $5,000 tree pop up, you know, in the building, in the new health house building. I can't remember what the name of it is, Manunda Place. You know, you go, that sort of shows you that you might be serious about making sure that you're reining in the spending, but is it not flowing through as far as it should be? And that's just one example. You know, like, that's just one example that I can think of off the top of my head.
And Katie, that example, that the chief executive, she was mortified. It was part of a gift-giving program. She was trying to work through morale, and we apologised at the time, and I made it clear.
But do you see what I mean, though? Everybody's mortified after the fact. Like, everybody's sort of sorry for it after the fact. But, you know, it shouldn't get to that point. And I'm not just saying your department, but any department. If we're in this level of debt, I think that, you know, they're either not worried that, you know, that they're going to get in trouble from you guys, or I don't know where it's breaking down.
I don't think there's any real accountability of the public service at all, because of this dichotomy, really, that's been set up around, you know, the Labor Party needing the public service to maintain them in government. You know, it will never change. I think that the Labor government is impotent when it comes to fixing the problems in the public service because of that. The public service is their insurance of maintaining government.
And it's, like, I think it's a really, like, it's a difficult situation that we're in, because I don't agree with the public service being slashed and burned. I think that we need to make sure that we have a public service that is...
I don't think anyone does.
No, that's right. But we don't want the population to be in decline. We want to make sure that we
have a public service to grow your economy. Like,
you
they're
do.
The people that, you know, put in place the regulations. They're the people that make sure your environment's protected. You've got to make sure that your balance of public service is either delivering those frontline jobs that you need in that police, health, youth justice, child protection space, education, or secondly, what role are they doing in facilitating? And the economy is predicted to grow by over 4%. And so, you know, I know in the space of the environment, it's an issue. People are concerned. They want to know about water security, but they want to welcome development, but it has to be done in an accountable way. So that's the role that your public service plays.
But that's where government can be doing more. I mean, a lot of our policies are around making the public service work better with the private sector. I mean, ultimately, the public service is there to deliver a public service, and it has to be that way. And I think what we've got is a disconnect, and that's not particularly, it's not the public service's fault or the private sector's fault, but it's about leading from the top. And I think what we've got is, you know, truly, it is an incompetent government who are being led around by their CEOs and the public service who need leadership. They look to their ministers for the strategy and the overall direction. I mean, we have a chief minister who is rudderless. We do not know what his vision is for the territory. He just says random words all the time that don't really make any sense. And if you don't have a cohesive vision as a government, then the 25,000 public service that work for you can't follow along. And I think that's the problem. And then there's chopping and changing of policy direction. There's the super departments that just make it impossible to be able to do anything. I think a classic example of this is with major projects. We've had the Langlands Review and the Turk Report say that's a big problem. We've got to roll out the red carpet for investment. And government's solution to that was to promote three existing public service in very similar roles and just call them commissioners and hope that that's going to make some sort of meaningful change to grow our economy. It's just not. I mean, those people probably were notified about it about a few hours after the press release came out. You know, it's just, that's not meaningful change. That's just adding in layers of bureaucracy, and it's not what the private sector want to see. And I'm actually really sure it's not what the public service want to see either. I think they're as frustrated as anybody else.
360's The Week That Was. Thanks to DeSilva Hebron, your local lawyers.
You are listening to The Week That Was, and joining us in the studio this morning, Leah Finocchiaro, Robin Lamley and Natasha Files. Now, the Territory Government, well, it's finally happening. They have brought in a suite of measures in an effort to cut crime and keep the community safe and put victims first. They say the measures are going to include tougher than ever consequences for breach of bail, meaning that if a young person commits a serious breach while on bail, their bail's going to be automatically revoked and they will be taken into custody. Police are also going to be given more powers to tackle youth crime through expanded options to apply electronic monitoring. There's also going to be the family, I can't think of the word right now, responsibility agreements, and a number of other measures. There is definitely some groups, we've got some Indigenous health groups and some other youth justice groups who have called out and said that, you know, this is not appropriate. It's a step backwards. I think that you'd have to argue, though, that the community is saying, why has it taken so long?
Oh, 100%. I mean, the government have been dragged kicking and screaming to this debate. Of course, crime has been out of control for a long time. 2 years ago, they changed the laws, weakened bail, weakened everything, and things have just skyrocketed from there. Alice Springs has been a war zone. They've been largely ignored and forgotten by the Gunner government. And it took a current affair. It took us to become the nation's shame. It took the opposition preparing its own bail legislation. It took all of the community, all of the years, all of the petitions, all of the angst, all of the anxiety, all of the victims to finally get to a point where the Gunner government have cobbled something together. Now, I sat down with Jared Maley last night for hours and hours and hours to try and work through what the government is proposing. And I think it must be as complicated as it is, because there's things to hide. There's something hidden.
There's a few rats in there.
But what do you mean? What's in there?
Well, I have not been able to get through all of it. It is a monster. It just... And, you know, legislation can be complicated. I'm not saying it's not doesn't need to be complicated, but it just, I smell a rat. What it does do, what we can glean so far, is that it only really targets serious breaches of bail whilst someone is on bail. So it's very specific in that respect. And then we haven't got to the bottom of what actually happens to that person. So the words are that your bail will be revoked. So if you're on bail, so only if you're a youth on bail, you commit a serious breach of bail, which is things like violent act causing death, suffering serious harm, terrorism, etc., then your bail will be revoked. But what it goes on to say is that you end up in the custody of the CEO. Now, that's not defined in the legislation, so I don't know what that means. And we don't think that necessarily means jail. That might mean bail accommodation. It might mean going into the care of Territory families. And, Natasha, I don't know if you know what custody of the CEO means. Does that mean bail revoked, go to jail?
So I'm not sure which specific part of the act that you're looking at, but Katie, this bill proposes what we believe are sensible measures. We certainly heard from the community, and of the figures, when you look at it, there is a number of young people that are reoffending across the territory, causing a large amount of harm in our community, and it's unacceptable. And so this bill is aimed at targeting those young people. We still need to have those safe, thriving and connected communities. We need to give young people a chance and provide that pathway in terms of this bill, we believe it targets that percentage of young people that are continually reoffending.
Well, so, it doesn't really target reoffending, though. That's the thing. It only targets youth who are on bail. So, for example, if you are a youth and you've got a 10-page long rap sheet, you're not on bail at the time of a serious offence. So say you do something, like I said, serious assaults on police who suffer harm, terrorism, anything like that. So if you've got it, you've got a massive, you're a youth, you've got a massive rap sheet, but you're not on bail, you go on to commit a serious offence, those revoking bail provisions don't kick in. Now, other things might kick in, but that doesn't. So
just repeat that again.
But if you're not on bail, Leah, that means that you have been sentenced and you have done.
Yes, but it means you're a repeat offender. It means you're a repeat offender and you're not being dealt with. So under this legislation, if you are a repeat offender, that isn't really taken into consideration when it comes to this tough talk around revocation of bail if you breach. It only applies.
You just said it. This is around revocation of bail.
That's right, but it only applies
to people.
I'll give you the opposite example. I'm a first-time offender. I'm on bail and I commit a serious offence. Then this kicks in. I've got a 10-page rap sheet. I'm not on bail and I commit a serious offence. This doesn't kick in.
But if you've got a criminal history in the past and you're not on bail, that means your criminal history has been dealt with and therefore this would be considered.
And so it doesn't matter if you've got a long history of criminal offences. If you're not on bail, you're going to be dealt with as if you're a first-time offender.
No, you're not dealt with as if you're a first-time offender. But this legislation is around bail. But what I'm saying, Katie, is in 2020 there was 116 offenders who committed half of those offences in the territory. So this is targeting where we acknowledge from the community it's not acceptable. If a young person's on bail from an offence and then they're committing more offences, that's not acceptable. We need to close that loophole. And what is that loophole between police and the courts? We need to make sure that there's absolute clarity around if the courts have said that a young person must participate or must be sentenced to something, that they have to participate in that. The court needs to have that oversight when it comes back before them.
Well, we're a little bit... sitting here listening to this, and I know Alice Springs people will be listening to this show later today, and I am fuming. You know, it's all very well to tease out the ins and outs of this legislation that is going through Parliament next week, but our town in Alice Springs has been falling apart for years now, and it's not unlike many other parts of the Northern Territory. Why has it taken so long? I don't hold any great hope out for this legislative change. I think it's come all too little, too late. The damage that has been done to the reputation of Alice Springs and the broader Northern Territory will take many, many years to repair. People are not coming to Alice Springs because of our reputation already. Look, why has this government taken so long to respond, Natasha? It is unforgivable. It is something that will scar us for a very long, long time into the future. Are you really serious about trying to fix the problems, or is this just another token effort?
It's political. It's 100% political, Robin. And, I mean, you know, we're calling this bit the get-out-of-jail-free card. I mean, there's this massive loophole at the end of the bail provisions that says, basically, if a person's lawyer can establish that the breach of bail was trivial, technical or exceptional in its circumstance, then off you go, you're off the hook. And again, those terms aren't defined. So we're really
what's
concerned.
Different? It's just
we're
BS.
Not sure, and
this
I haven't worked through
BS.
It's and the other thing is this legislation does not target adults. So our legislation targeted youth and adults. We said if you have done twice, then you start with a position of no bail. It does deal with some of those presumptions of bail, but not for everything.
So can I ask, Natasha, what is now defined as a prescribed offence? Because that was something that was certainly a concern from the get-go as well, that some more serious things were not actually defined.
Prescribed offence list has been lengthened, and the minister read that out in the House, and that's a part of the bill, those prescribed offences. But Katie, it's a youth bill. We believe that youth should be treated differently to adults, and so this is focused on, and it's that number of young people that are the repeat offenders that are committing those crimes. So that's what this bill is focused on. There's also a number of other measures that we've implemented, but these are hard grinding issues to solve. But we certainly heard from the community that what they're seeing is unacceptable.
Look, this is Labor's attempt to sit on the fence. Mm. You know, you adopted the recommendations of the Royal Commission in 2017. You implemented all the strategies that led to a complete state of lawlessness across most parts of the Northern Territory now. And now you're trying to withdraw from that position and find a position that really is appeasing the likes of, you know, Alice Springs people, but also trying to kind of save face to the left side of politics. The social services, Amnesty International side of politics that were really quite in favour of the recommendations of the Royal Commission. And you're sitting yourself in the middle, but will that be adequate enough to change anything? I doubt it, Natasha.
I don't think so.
I really think that this is tokenistic and it's not going far enough. And the strategies that you're wrapping around it, family responsibility agreements, well, I'm optimistic that they might work this time around. But they've been out there for 10 years or more. Mm. They didn't work years ago. They haven't worked since. Maybe the Minister for Territory Families will come up with a better way of implementing this. Diversion is a bloody joke. Mm. No one can even define what it is half the time. There's no measures of how effective it is. It could be as little as, you know, someone visiting someone who's on bail once a week or teaching them how to drive or taking them down the road for a milkshake. You know, like diversion is failing despite the good intentions of all the people that are working to try and make it successful and effective. Look, you've put yourself in such a situation where, you know, you've taken us to the pit of lawlessness and crime, and now you're trying to convince us through some measly legislation, amendments to legislation, that this is going to be the panacea.
That's the view from the opposition.
Well, doing that, Natasha? You've disappointed us for years. You know, people have suffered. There's people out there who have truly suffered financially, socially, mentally, psychologically, and this is what we get.
Yeah. And they will continue to suffer.
The day, you know, if this legislation, if it does not make a change, I honestly don't know what to tell you with the way that the community's feeling. And I know that, you know, I do think it's made people feel a little bit calmer at the moment, knowing that there's some legislation coming in, hoping that it makes some changes. I totally agree that we don't want to be, you know, locking kids up and throwing away the key. But if we cannot make some change in this space, it worries me. You know, the impact of the territory.
Katie, what this is about is targeting those 100 odd children who committed half the offences, youth offences, in the territory. And so it's around that repeat offending. It's around there is no bail if you commit a serious offence. So the bill's been introduced to the House. Leah and Robin obviously have very strong opinions on it, and it will be debated out next week. They will be able to go through that committee stage and ask all the questions and get their answers. But legislation does need to be agile. It does need to, you know, coming back to Robin's point, yes, we have had the Royal Commission in 2016, but we need to make sure that we're always reviewing legislation that it meets the needs and the expectations, well, importantly enough, of the community.
Meet the expectations.
And, you know, one other scary part in this bill, Katie, you talked about prescribed offences before. So the government has heard everyone's cries that the serious offences list was weak as anything. But let me tell you a couple of the offences that are still not on the serious offences list. Threats to kill, home invasion, business invasion. Now, I don't know about you, Katie, but I'm pretty sure most of your listeners will probably be really interested to know about home invasion and business invasion.
So
and
if that's you, if still you've got someone in your house, if someone gets into your home, that's not on
well, there. However the law describes a home invasion and a business invasion, that is not a serious offence. So if you are on bail and you commit a home or business invasion or threat to kill, that is not a serious offence. So that particular bail provision will not kick in either. So there's still a lot of question marks. Look, we'll support it if it helps even a tiny, tiny bit. But I think this is a smoke and mirrors exercise. It's absolutely political. It's a desperate response. We saw them cobble this together. And, you know, whether it makes any difference, no one will know. But the impact is huge. And, you know, the Chief Minister's budget reply to link the two together barely touched on crime, but the cost is profound, not only to police and resourcing and all of those things, but to business. You know, people having to spend $5,000 every time their glass is broken into. You know, I know a cafe in town that's been done 9 times since they opened late last year. Then there's the social and the, you know, the emotional issues that stay with people after becoming victims. It is truly profound. And then, of course, there's people who just have enough, they leave. There's the suffering of the tourism sector. I mean, tourism Alice Springs, Central Australia, their biggest issue is crime, not whether we get cheap flights or all these other amazing initiatives. You know, it's crime. That's craziness.
360's The Week That Was, thanks to the Silver Hebron, your local lawyers.
You are listening to The Week That Was. Leah Finocchiaro, Robin Lamley and Natasha Files in the studio with me. And I did just get a message from Jerry Wood and it says, So why the urgency? If so many issues are being raised, where's the scrutiny committee? Jerry wants to know.
Oh, good question.
Jerry,
where is the scrutiny committee?
Anything going through an urgency. He always respected the process of Parliament. And
but, you know, the scrutiny committee was great and this government scrapped it just like it scrapped our representations on the Estimates
point,
Committee,
Jerry.
Like on the Public Accounts Committee. That is cut scrutiny. That's what they cut. We cut crime, they cut scrutiny. Go figure.
And speaking of Jerry, I did message him earlier in the week because I obviously became aware of the fact that the number of opposition members allowed on the Estimates Committee had changed. And so I got in contact with Jerry because, in my opinion, I don't know whether we'd call him the godfather or the grandfather of politics, but he, you know, he is very much an independent and he's been around for an awfully long time. And I wondered whether that is something that had ever happened before. Now, from his perspective, he said that it wasn't, you know, it was certainly hadn't been the case. And I did do a bit of investigating myself and saw that in New South Wales and Queensland, there is more than one opposition member on those committees, the Estimates Committee, which scrutinises that government spending. Now, for anybody out there listening who's thinking, what the heck is Estimates and what are you talking about? So it's the process where the opposition and the independents do have the opportunity to ask the government and to scrutinise the government on some of the spending within different departments.
On all of the spending.
On all of that spending. And it's not just the ministers that are there to answer those questions. It is also the government departmental heads that are there to answer some of those questions as well. So it's not supposed to be a political thing. Mm. It's supposed to be an opportunity, like I said, for the opposition and the independents to get that information. Now, throughout the week, we learned that the government had made the decision to cut the number of those opposition members allowed on the Estimates Committee from 2 down to 1. There is still one independent
That's right.
as well
yeah.
On that committee. Now, look, again, I know some people listening might be thinking, well, how does this impact my everyday life? Mm. And I am very passionate and very firm on the fact that no matter who is in government, they should be held to account. And whoever is in opposition should have the opportunity to ask those questions of government on the community's behalf. Now, I can't understand why we now are going down this path where the number of people who are able to ask those questions on that committee are changing, Filesy.
So any member of the Legislative Assembly can come to the estimates hearings. I think it was last
year,
the year before.
So they can come, can they sit there and ask questions? Those questions
any 25 members can come in. So I think it was maybe a year or so ago, the member for Mulca was not a member, but he came and asked questions at that committee. So
but
it is an open hearing.
Why did you reduce the number of opposition members? Why did you do that?
So the committee has 3 government and 2 non-government members, and any member of the Assembly can go and ask questions.
Why did
it's
you
as
reduce
simple
that?
As that.
It's just power. It is just power, insecurity and arrogance. It's because they can. In history, in the Territory, you have 3 government, 2 opposition, 1 independent. Government has the casting vote. Now, it is not a government process. It is an opposition independent process. So for those listening at home, we have
a committee of the parliament.
Yeah, there's a panel in front. The ministers are there. The public servants are there. And then the members of a parliament are there. And it's much more interactive. It's not like parliament where it's adversarial. It's like we've got budget books, we're scrutinising line items. There's lots of talking and interaction. This is an opportunity now for the government to filibuster, to basically ask their own Dorothy Dixes to waste and take up time. It shows their deep-seated insecurity. A good government has a good opposition. Now, we are a good opposition, and these guys do not like it, and that's why they've cut us down.
Through this process, let's say we're going through the health spending. So how long would the opposition have to ask questions? How long would the independents have to ask questions? And then if other... all right. And
yeah.
So then
7-8 times.
And
yeah.
So then if you've
very
got...
very respectful too, yeah, usually.
We do.
We take turns.
And so then if you've got others who do want to come along and ask questions as well, they've got to work with the opposition and the independent who are on the committee in terms of...
As Robin was just saying, the committee, you have the minister with their chief executive or the people in charge of those divisions, and you have any member of the Assembly can come. Generally, you go through, because it's the budget appropriation bill, so you're going output by output, and generally what happens is there's a line of questioning on an output. So the questions start from the shadow minister and then they can come from other members through
the
process.
And so what was the reason for changing it?
So the Estimates Committee reflects the membership usually of the PAC Committee, and so it's 3 and 2.
Which they reduced.
So why has there been the reduction?
So it's... Katie, as I said, any member can come. It's
3. I know the answer.
Why has there been the reduction?
So, Katie, it's 3 government, 2 non-government members. It's fairly straightforward.
It's because Mark Turner, the dishonest and whatever else he
be
is...
Be careful what you say. You haven't got privilege in here.
No. That's the Chief Minister's words, not mine. He got... exiled to the crossbench. I mean, that's the reality. The reality is, in the previous term, it was 3-2-1. This government came in, was terrifying.
3-2-1,
and now, Mark Turner's not there to be your fourth heavyweight on the committee, and so you've cut us down. The reality is you still have the power, you still have the control. This is just an act because you have the power to do it. It's just a play. It's political nonsense. It's arrogant.
So I do want to ask, though, as well, because we are fast running out of time, but we also know that in Parliament we learned earlier in the week in what's been described really as a surprise move that the Leader of Government Business, yourself, Filesy, passed that motion in Parliament to extend the Privileges Committee's deadline for reporting on the matter of Mark Turner and what they were looking into with that investigation. That report now, it's not going to be handed down to Parliament, as I understand it, until May next year.
No, it's not May. So, Katie, we know that, and I do need to be careful because the Privileges is a committee of the House and you need to be careful what you say, but we know publicly that the Privileges Committee had a referral. We know publicly that the ICAC is looking into a matter. We know that the ICAC has different legislation and also quite extensive resources in terms of research. All this correspondence says we know there's another investigation. It pushes out the date that we deliver back to the first parliamentary sittings next year. It could be earlier, but it is to that date.
But that's an awfully long period of time. Like, we're in May now. How
Katie,
come
we're acknowledging that there's another investigation taking place.
And so they can't happen at the same time.
So, Katie, I need to be very careful because the Privileges is a committee of the Parliament and I can't publicly speak about what goes on within that committee meetings.
But surely I be able to ask whether both of those investigations can happen at the same time?
So, Katie, all I can say is there's a referral to the Privileges Committee that has been granted by the Assembly, an extension to the beginning of next year. We also know there's an ICAC investigation.
We think there should be more transparency breathed into it, into this. We tried yesterday to do various things in the Parliament that would at least get the Privileges Committee to provide Territorians with an update on where they're at or what is proposed to be done going forward. We think that's fair given the, of course, level of interest. Of course, the person in question still sits in the Parliament, etc. So we think the government needs to be more transparent around this decision, and we've certainly put that to them through the Parliament.
Through the committee process, but I can't say more than that.
The problem that we have, Katie, with our parliamentary committee system is they're designed to provide additional scrutiny of government. But the way the government has set them up is they've got the majority of numbers on every committee. They chair every committee. And so they basically determine the outcome of every committee. And here we have a situation with Mark Turner being referred to the Privileges Committee. And for some strange reason, as you've already stated, this the determination of the Privileges Committee about what happens to him has been pushed out to next year. Now, we will not know the truth exactly what's going on in this space probably ever.
Well,
but it's curious and it creates suspicion and it creates more questions around just what this government is on about.
Well, and fundamentally, I think that no matter what the outcome of that investigation, at the end of the day, we are talking about somebody who's there to represent his electorate. And I think that, you know, if it's found that there's no wrongdoing and that nothing's gone on, then, you know, he should be entitled to do that without a cloud over his head as well. From the other perspective. So, you know, I think that, like, realistically, we've got to look at that electorate as well and how it's best represented.
Yeah.
360's The Week That Was. Thanks to De Silva Hebron, your local lawyers.
Well, we are running out of time. You are listening to The Week That Was. And joining me in the studio, Leah Finocchiaro, Robin Lamley and Natasha Files. Now, before we wrap up for the morning, I do want to talk about the situation with the India repatriation flights and Howard Springs. We know that it's expected, and Filesy, maybe you'll be able to clarify for us, it is expected that the Prime Minister is going to announce those plans today about those repatriation flights. And it was sounding yesterday like we are going to be the location that those repatriated Australians from India are going to be coming to here at Howard Springs.
So my understanding is the Prime Minister announced this morning that there will be three flights during May from India into Howard Springs. He hasn't made an announcement on commercial flights. So there was commercial flights going into, I think, New South Wales was still accepting them. So they're just working through that. We saw that rate of infectivity 7 times what we anticipated. We always knew we'd get around 2% infectivity rate on those flights. We had over 15%, and that was when we saw the numbers over 50. So we reduced, or the flights were paused so that we could manage that. It was also compounded with a new strain of the virus in India that was causing concern for our clinicians. And there's also measures that the Prime Minister and DFAT will put in place pre-flight to try and reduce those numbers of infectivity.
How many people can we handle out at Howard Springs with COVID?
So we treat everyone as though they've got COVID, but when they do actually get COVID, they get moved into a red zone. And I think all but a handful were cared for at Howard Springs. It's the problem we need to, and part of not knowing what this new strain was going to do was if those people got critically ill, they would need to be transferred to hospital. We have a number of different redundancies, and we went through this when we were expecting coronavirus in our community last year. And so when we hit that 50 or over 50, if those people had all taken ill, severely ill, that would have caused a burden not only on the territory health system, but interstate as well. So there was some complexity.
50 really is our max.
50 is that sort of working number, but we're working with the Commonwealth to make sure that we've reduced the infectivity on those flights, that rapid antigen testing before they get on the flights. And then if we do start to see those numbers come up again, what can we do to repatriate people interstate like we did with Wuhan and Diamond Princess?
Katie, I think we've bitten off more than we can chew here. I think that we're really moving into a very, very dangerous situation. I think that, you know, the fact that we have been so successful at keeping COVID out, quarantining all these people, probably has is starting to work against us because, you know, obviously the federal government thinks that we can take on all these people coming through from India. Look, we only have one tertiary hospital in Darwin and, you know, I think probably all it would take is a handful of cases for things to get completely out of hand. So I'm concerned.
Let's not forget the Gunner government have just accepted a $514 million cheque from the federal government.
That's wrong, Leah, and you know it's wrong.
It was in your budget. How much was it? The chief minister said in his budget, we got the $514 million.
It's a pay on invoice, Katie, and I want to make that really clear to Territorians.
Well, then why was it in the budget?
Because we are, any cost that is incurred for the Howard Springs facility is covered by the Commonwealth, but if those costs come under, we don't keep that difference. So there's no incentive.
Well, I'm just saying what the chief minister said. If he was bluffing around, that's his bloody problem.
The Prime Minister did say on this show as well that it was $500 million.
Yeah, the figure's $500 million that it's estimated to run that facility.
Okay.
But I want to make it clear, it's not like, oh, if we scrimp and save and eat, have, you know...
All right, well, in any event, that's not my point.
There is budget there, so the Territory taxpayer... Correct. We're not making money, but there is not a cost on the Territory taxpayer.
I never said there was a cost on the Territory taxpayer. My point is...
You just said that we accepted $500 million.
You accept $500 million to run international quarantine and phase out, kick out, whatever words you want to use, the AusMat team. Now, that international quarantine has been a fantastic gold standard facility because AusMat have been there and now the Territory government is going
to
take that over. You've come under a lot of pressure. No, it's not.
It is.
You can say that. It is absolutely not. To be an AusMat, there are all manner of qualifications and things you have to go through.
So
now we're seeing this slow transition because you've come under pressure. We just certainly hope that the Territory, I mean, you've only hired 160 of the 400 you need to run that facility. And we certainly hope that you can continue to manage this at the gold standard as AusMat have, because the international quarantine, that's where our greatest risk is.
We have run out of time. We always run out of time. In fact, we've gone over a little bit. Apologies. We will head across to the national news. Thank you all so much for your time this morning.
Happy Mother's Day.
Robin Lamley, Natasha Files. Yes, I hope you all have a lovely Mother's Day on Sunday as well.
Me too.
Thank you. You're listening to Mix 104.9's 360. That was The Week That Was.